This is KPOO, San Francisco, where we're burning bird. Shimma shimma. Shimma shimma. Shimma shimma. Let me in. Shimma shimma. I want to be closer to you. Shimma shimma. Open up your soul. Shimma shimma. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. It's Scintillating Science Monday. That means there's a scientist here who explained things in a way that you actually understand it as opposed to when you were in school. And I'm very excited because they look just like their picture. You can't tell because it's radio, but I can. And this scientist is going to be explaining a whole bunch of stuff that I don't understand, but we'll understand after the end of the show. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Bethany Ann Suter. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
So Bethany, before we get into what you actually do scientific-wise,
yeah.
When did you first get bitten by the science bug?
Well, I was pretty young, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of liked science from middle school on, but wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do
mm-hmm.
with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was actually homeschooled. So One of the things my mom did was she just got me a ton of different science books from the library.
Okay.
I was like, explore, figure out what you want to actually like focus on. Because like science is very broad.
Sure.
There's a lot of different aspects that you could go into. And so I kind of read a lot of those books and realized that I was like most interested in the physics one specifically.
Mm-hmm. How long were you homeschooled? Was it all the way through
high school?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So your mom was like, here's a bunch of books, read them. Did she read them too so that you could ask questions, or how did that work?
So a lot of them were like popular science books. So if I had questions, I could often like go to the internet and stuff to figure things out.
Oh, okay.
My mom didn't have a ton of science background,
uh-huh.
so her writing them alongside of me, she probably would have had just as many questions as
okay,
I did.
Okay. But from that, you just go, I really like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you go from being homeschooled, which is one-on-one tutoring,
right,
to a college environment. So how did that transition work when, you know, because your mom is like always there on top of you, whereas in college it's like, well, if you'll do it or you won't.
Yeah, so I actually graduated a year early and then took some classes at a community college.
Oh, okay.
So I feel like that was enabling me to, you know, I was still living at home, I was still around my family and
mm-hmm.
stuff, but I was able to like start getting more used to, you know, what it means to take a class from like a professor.
Right. With a bunch of other students.
With a bunch of other students, exactly.
Okay.
Taking tests in person was definitely a change.
Okay. So you go off to college, and does your love of science solidify, or do you take a circuitous route to get to where you want to go?
Yeah, it was actually pretty straightforward. So after I went to the community college for a year, I then did like the applications for more traditional four-year colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually went to Caltech for undergrad then. And Caltech's actually a really small school, so it's only about 1,000 undergrads, which I really liked, knowing
uh-huh.
that I was coming from homeschooling
sure.
background. I was
uh-huh.
like, this is awesome. This is going to be better because now I'm at UC Berkeley as a grad student, and that's a big difference given
yes.
it's like 40,000 grads,
yes,
undergrad yes. students.
So you go to a smaller college.
Mm-hmm.
You are taking classes with a professor who's actually now able to answer your questions. You're
yes.
not sort of looking under the internet, which
mm-hmm.
may or may not be giving you the. Actually, let me ask you this. When you were looking things up on the internet, how were you able as a young person to discern between that information that was actually vetted and proper versus information that just like some Yahoo like me could put up?
Yeah, that's a good question. Honestly, I don't know if I had like always the best sense of it, but like I was trying to, you know, be open to what the things were saying, but also take it with a grain of salt, you know?
Okay.
So I think I usually trusted things that came in books more than stuff I would find on the internet. So it'd be like checking like small facts kind of thing, or if it was like something concept that I didn't understand as much, I would go to like Wikipedia, which, you know, people don't actually think it's a very good source and are like, oh, you can't cite Wikipedia, but it's actually pretty well rigorously tested and, you know, people really try to make sure that it's actually very accurate and more accessible.
So while you're in school, how do you stumble across the science that grabbed you?
Yeah, so I think it was even a little bit earlier. So when I was in high school, when I was reading some of those books, I specifically like latched on to a lot of like high energy particle physics books.
In high school?
In high school, yeah.
See, that's the difference between homeschooling. Like, you know, it's not standardized. So you want to study particle physics, go nuts.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I wasn't like getting into any of the mathematics. It was a lot of like the conceptual stuff at that point.
Okay.
But I just... it entranced me, you know, I was like kind of hooked. And so then once I got to undergrad, it was the kind of thing where I just wanted to go as kind of fast and like learn as much stuff as I could.
Okay.
So did a lot of different classes and stuff. Yeah.
All right. So fast forward. So you talk about being fascinated by particle physics.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say that I had the opposite experience of you in my science upbringing is abysmal. So what is particle physics?
So let's see. So when we think of particles, you can, you know, maybe think people think of like atoms and stuff.
Yep, that's the first thing that popped into my mind.
So particle physics is this so if you're looking at atoms, that's actually considered more atomic physics or nuclear physics, which are two other fields of physics.
Okay.
So if we think of particle physics, we're actually thinking of things even smaller than atoms.
Like quarks?
So yeah, exactly. So the fundamental building blocks that I tend to work with are things like quarks and leptons.
And what?
And leptons.
What are leptons? That's the first time I'm hearing that.
Ah, excellent. So do you know what quarks are?
They're tinier than atoms. I know that.
Yes. So I guess to start, maybe the three particles that people are most familiar with are protons, neutrons, and electrons.
Yes.
Yeah. So if we want to put those into categories, protons and neutrons are actually not fundamental particles. They're made up of quarks. So that's how you can like do that relation.
All right.
But electrons, at least as far as we know, obviously more experimentation needs to be done.
Sure.
As far as we know, they are fundamental particles. And so things,
it doesn't get any smaller.
Exactly.
But an atom can be broken down into
protons, neutrons, and electrons.
And protons and neutrons can further be broken down.
Exactly. Into quarks.
And can quarks be further broken down?
As far as we know, again, with caveat,
more
experimentation needed.
Because we used to think that it didn't get any smaller. What about leptons? Where do they fit into the pantheon of atomic particles?
Yeah. So electrons are kind of lepton.
A kind of lepton. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the definition of a lepton then?
So this is where it gets complicated.
Okay.
So there are, you know, there are four fundamental forces that maybe people are aware of.
Okay.
So there's gravity, electromagnetism, which is like dealing with like photons or light, and charge.
Okay.
So like, you know, electrons are positively charged.
Okay.
Or negatively charged, sorry. Electrons, positrons. Then there's a weak force, which people know of as dealing with, like, radioactivity.
Okay.
So if you're interested in nuclear energy, then you're going to care about the weak force a lot. And then there's a strong force. And the strong force is what binds. So if we have those quarks and we say they're stuck together to make a proton or a neutron, there needs to be a reason they're stuck together. And that reason is the strong force.
And it's not electromagnetic. So what? How does it differ? How to Weaken Strong Force, which, by the way, seem like pretty lame names for things. Like, everything else has its own name, and then they're kind of naming it in, like, you know, bodybuilding terms.
Oh, absolutely. It's very funny.
So I'm still not clear on what, how it differs from any other type of force. So you say weak force, strong force.
Mm-hmm.
How do they differ from electromagnetism?
Yeah. So in electromagnetism, right, we know that we have positive charges and negative charges.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if you have two positive charges, they're going to repel each other,
yes.
Right? If you have two negative charges, they also repel each other.
Sure.
If you have a positive charge and a negative charge, they attract each other.
Okay.
But if we look at these protons, if you look at the charges of those quarks,
mm-hmm.
you actually end up getting two positive charges and one negative charge.
Mm.
And somehow you're fitting them really, really close together.
Okay.
And so we
call
it
like Lego bricks.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So we call it the strong force because it's stronger than electromagnetism because it's keeping charges that are like charges, which normally we're like, oh, those should not be close together, really, really close together.
Oh, okay. So you're saying, okay, I get it. So the two positive charges mm-hmm. that normally would repel each other
mm-hmm.
because of this other thing, they're like tight together
uh-huh.
like twins, and then they stick together like
yeah,
Lego
exactly.
bricks.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, now I get why they describe it in terms of degree as opposed to giving it its own name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how did we get on this subject?
Yeah. So basically, the reason we kind of have these different quarks and leptons
mm-hmm.
is, one, just like we know that quarks, you know, fit together and make these protons and neutrons. So they kind of seem different, I guess.
Okay.
But they also, we kind of classify them based on which of the forces they actually interact with. So
okay.
not all particles are going to interact with every single force.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so, for instance, leptons don't care at all. I caught myself. they don't care at all about the strong force.
Okay.
But these quarks do care.
Okay. So, leptons, when you say, okay, so the leptons don't care,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're like honey badger. But does that mean that the lepton can just sort of attach to anything? Or when you say it doesn't care, what does that mean?
Yeah, so I guess, let's see. So maybe the best way of thinking about it is in terms of electromagnetism, because that's what they're most used to.
Okay.
So in electromagnetism, there are particles that have charge,
mm-hmm.
and then there are some particles that don't have charge.
Okay.
And those particles, you can put them as close as you want to something with positive charge or negative charge, and it's just not going to care. They're not going to be repelled. They're not going to be attracted.
Oh, okay.
So you can just like – they're just not interacting in that,
got
in that
it.
Way.
Got it.
It's the same kind of thing for these leptons with the strong force.
They're just hanging out
yeah.
and things are like, hey, let's hook up. And mm-hmm. they're like, I don't care.
And other forces might still affect them. So we know that electromagnetism affects them. We know that gravity affects them because
mm-hmm.
all of these particles that we're talking about have mass. And that's how gravity interacts. That's like its charge.
Okay. So then what is if the lepton isn't actually interacting
mm-hmm.
with the other things, then what's its purpose?
Well, we wouldn't be here today without leptons.
Because?
So if we look at atoms,
mm-hmm.
We know that the nucleus of the atom, so that's like the tiny little part at the very center,
okay.
that's made up of protons and neutrons.
Okay.
And then all around that mm-hmm. is swarming with electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And what the purpose of those electrons are, well, they do lots of things. We wouldn't have modern computing without them.
Okay.
But the main purpose is that if you just had this ball of charge,
mm-hmm.
just like that nucleus charge,
okay,
and you tried just separating it away from those electrons,
mm-hmm.
then electromagnetism is actually such a strong force that we would just be ripped apart. if you try to take away all of those electrons, because it's so much charge, that's actually going to be a strong enough force that, like, not only would we feel it, but, like, it would, yeah, it could potentially tear us apart.
So you're saying that the act of trying to remove a, you know, a floating, mm-hmm. I forget, neutron, whatever.
Electrons, yeah.
Okay, that the act of trying to remove it is enough to destroy life.
Yeah, if we didn't have them, then we just wouldn't have atoms in the way that we know, and then they wouldn't form, like, the bonds that we know and stuff.
So do the leptons sort of, instead of using electromagnetism, are they there to just kind of keep the...
So this is exactly because of electromagnetism. So because those protons and neutrons have positive charge, mm-hmm. and the leptons, or the electrons in this case, have negative charge, then you kind of have a positive charge at a center.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you surround it by electrons, that kind of cancels out a lot of that charge.
Okay.
Right? So if you just look at a little bit of a, like, say you have a sphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the sphere, say, is just around the protons and neutrons.
Okay.
Then you're going to be like, okay, I have this amount of positive charge mm-hmm. in this center.
Mm-hmm.
And that exerts a force, which is called a Coulomb force.
Okay.
But if we bring this circle now outside of the atom, so we're including the electrons
that
and the
around.
Protons.
Uh-huh.
Then for most atoms, that's actually going to, the charge is going to sum to zero.
Okay.
So you're no longer going to have any charge that is producing a Coulomb force or an electromagnetic force.
Okay.
And so if you're, like, outside of that, you're just not going to experience any forces. So this is a process called screening.
Okay. So if you think of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and you take these. I'm going to say that it's a membrane filled with a nucleus and a bunch of things floating around
sure,
in
yeah.
it. So, is the lepton the thing that allows the atoms to all sort of get together and form something without actually collapsing upon each other into a dark black hole?
So, it's definitely part of it.
Okay.
I don't know that it would necessarily form a black hole because it's still not dense enough. So black holes require a lot of density of matter.
Okay.
But the repulsive force of electromagnetism does keep some of the matter, you know, farther apart. So like it can help.
Okay.
But in this case, I think the black hole part's not quite correct, but the fact that our atoms are, like, sticking together to mm-hmm. form our body, that's exactly correct. That would not happen without those electrons.
And I know I went down the rabbit hole of lepton because I was like, what the heck?
Yeah.
But, okay. So I'm looking at the description of what you do, and it says phenomenological projects. Now, what is a phenomenological project?
Yeah. So phenomenology mm-hmm. is, well, it's a term used in philosophy and particle physics. So
and I'm psychology, too.
And,
go on.
Oh, and psychology. Mm-hmm. Cool. I didn't know about that one. Uh-huh. But it's basically, if you look at, like, I think it's the Latin root of it, mm-hmm. it's like the study of, like, classifying things and organizing things together.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so for particle physics, if we're talking about phenomenology, basically what people want to do is they want to have an accurate classification mm-hmm. of all of the particles in nature that exist.
Oh, okay. That seems reasonable and impossible at the same time because you're talking about everything, right?
Yeah.
Everything on Earth, everything mm-hmm. in the sun. Where do you start with something like that? Do you start with the leaf and then doesn't it quickly get out of hand because you start realizing that, oh, this has these properties that could be over there or these properties that could be over there? Because, you know, I know when I'm trying to categorize just normal stuff, mm-hmm. when I'm putting things in a file, it's like, well, should I put it in this folder? But it's got this folder. So how do you categorize it in a way that's meaningful for other scientists?
Yeah, no, that's exactly a big problem. However, it ends up being a little bit simpler than categorizing things in our, you know,
why?
On the larger scale. Because if you look at your body,
mm-hmm.
if you look at the particle level, where we're talking about, again, mm-hmm. those protons, neutrons, and electrons,
mm-hmm.
for your body, that's pretty much all that's in it right now. Protons, electrons, neutrons.
Okay.
And so because it is that simple, where it's just a few things,
mm-hmm.
That leaves us, maybe there's other things out there, and there are, and mm-hmm. we're figuring that out as well. But it turns out that on this particle level, things are actually a little, like, you know, there's a lot of complicated math. There's still a lot of complicated modeling going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic components, there are fewer of them than you might think.
So when you are classifying things, you're just breaking it down into what the atoms are that make it up? Or are you breaking it down even further into how many quarks make up this proton? Or how does it get broken up?
Yeah, so in phenomenology, we have what's called a standard model.
Okay.
And this is basically kind of the cohesive sum of what we know about particles.
Okay.
And so usually we don't care so much about the numbers of particles, although, like, generally that's more of like a cosmology thing where, like, we care about maybe how many particles there are in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But what ends up happening is what we care about is the types of particles.
Okay.
So what we want to do is we want to say, okay, here is a particle that we found. What mm-hmm. is its mass? Does it have a charge? What forces does it interact with?
Okay.
And all of those kind of things are the things that we care about as particle physics phenomenology.
Okay. So let's take the human body. It's going to be pretty much the same set of atoms throughout, right?
There's going to be different kinds of atoms. So remember that we can put protons and neutrons and electrons all together,
mm-hmm.
and that makes atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so in chemistry, we actually have, 116 different atoms?
I will defer to you.
It's somewhere around there. It's 100 and something.
Uh-huh.
And so the lost my track of train of thought for a sec there.
Oh, about when you have the human body and what I'm trying to get at is uh-huh. you're saying that it's so simple. If it's so simple, then, you know,
how do we get the human body in the first place?
Well, if it's so simple, like our leaves, would the atoms that make up a leaf
mm-hmm.
be quantitatively different from the atoms that make up a person? I'm assuming yes, but it's just the same, like, five things, right?
Yeah, so it turns out that in like the human body or in leaves,
uh-huh.
A lot of the atoms that make it up, so that's going to be hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and you know, atoms that we've all mm-hmm. hopefully heard
mm-hmm.
about,
mm-hmm.
Those are most of the atoms that make up the human body.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to call those, like, organic atoms.
Okay.
Because they're, you know, inorganic things, mm-hmm. like humans and plants and animals and such. But yeah, so there's kind of these different levels of understanding, which is, like, actually a key thing for phenomenology as well, which is, like, so we have different levels of abstraction, I guess, is the idea.
Okay.
So we can look at things, you know, at the biology level where we're considering, you know, okay, this is a leaf, this is a human, this is a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can go to the atomic level,
mm-hmm.
which usually people consider is more of chemistry,
mm-hmm.
But it also can touch into physics as well. And so on that level, then we're going to be like, okay, the human body is made up of these different types of atoms.
Okay.
So nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, things like that.
And is that the same for every mammal or specifically humans?
So it's pretty much the same for every mammal.
Okay.
Definitely that selection of atoms is the same.
Mm-hmm.
There are some various atoms that, you know, humans might need and some animals would not. But
okay.
those are usually, like, very, very, very small percentages of your body.
Okay.
Okay. So if you ever thought about needing, like, vitamins and stuff,
mm-hmm.
sometimes that's because you need a specific, like, atom that maybe other animals would not need, or they do need as well, but
okay.
we just, like, take supplements for them.
Okay. So you're categorizing the heck out of everything.
Yeah.
So how much has been categorized so far?
Yes, so a lot. It turns out that for the vast majority of stuff that, you know, we interact with every day,
mm-hmm.
we know what it is mm-hmm. on the particle level. So
okay.
we know quarks, we know leptons, or protons, neutrons, and electrons. We know kind of what those are. We know how they interact.
Mm-hmm.
Those parts of the standard model, as I said earlier, are very well filled out.
Okay.
And it turns out that there are actually a few things that we don't know. And so this gets into actually what I work on mm-hmm. for my research.
Okay.
So one of the things that we don't know is actually, ironically, about 5/6 of the universe.
Okay.
But it's 5/6 of the universe that's actually completely black and dark and basically doesn't interact with light, as far as we know, at all. And so what, you know, physicists being very creative people, as you were noting earlier with the naming schemes, we call this dark matter.
Because we can't see it. It's dark.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Not to be confused with black holes, which are slightly different. So this is just dark.
But so when you say it's dark, it is that it's actually like you look out there and you can't see anything, but is it that there's actually nothing there, or you just can't see it, or is it that it's just it's on a level that can't be perceived by people? Or
so, well, there's a lot of stuff we know about dark matter. There's also a lot of stuff we don't know about dark matter.
Okay.
So we do know that we can't see it. So it could be a big enough object that, like, if it was I don't know, sitting in this room with us,
mm-hmm.
then you would not see anything, but you could tell something was there. Like, you'd be able to touch it.
Yeah, like in science fiction
exactly.
when they do that little blobby thing and they're like,
potentially you'd be able to touch it. Potentially not, because again, a lot of how we actually touch stuff is mm-hmm. through electromagnetism, surprisingly enough. So if I'm touching my fingers together, as you can see right now, I'm not actually touching.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like I'm touching.
Sure.
But it's the electrons in one of my fingers is bumping up with the electrons in my other finger. And from electromagnetism, again, we know that that's a repulsive force. So those particles are not actually touching in my finger.
That makes sense to me because mathematically you can never actually get – you never get to zero mathematically.
Right.
Like you just keep cutting in half the distance. So I like knowing that that's true.
Yeah, it is. So again, depending exactly on how dark matter interacts, we don't mm-hmm. know exactly. Maybe you'd be able to touch it and the forces would repulse you. Maybe not. But you would be able to use an instrument to actually detect that it was there.
Okay.
'Cause one of the main ways that we know dark matter has to exist is because it interacts with things gravitationally, which means it has a mass.
Okay.
And so say we tried to bring an object really close to, say we had a ball of dark matter here and
mm-hmm.
we tried to bring an object really close to it, there would be an attractive force.
Okay. So you know something's there, you just can't see it.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And that's got to be exciting to have this area that it's just a mystery that you're trying to crack. So how do you go about cracking that mystery?
Yeah, so that's the big question.
Oh, okay.
or
how do you personally,
how do I
Bethany,
personally?
Go about cracking that mystery in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, so what I generally am working on is actually trying to figure out if there are specific materials that might interact with dark matter more strongly than other materials.
Okay.
Either more strongly or in maybe different ways than we've tested before.
Okay.
Because So we know that 5/6 of the universe is dark matter, as
mm-hmm.
I said before. We don't know
how. We'll call it a mystery.
Yes.
5/6 is a mystery.
A mystery. And importantly, we think it's some sort of like particle object, which means it would be really, really small, which then in that case would mean if it's 5/6 of the universe and there's not a reason for it to be specifically concentrated in certain areas, a ton, then there might actually be dark matter, you know, going through this room right now. As I was saying earlier, we pretty much know everything that's like around us, but it is possible that there are some stuff or we're going around us right now that we aren't able to see and don't know. And if it's really, really small, you know, we're not going to detect that by just like trying to touch it or something
Right.
Just like we don't see electrons and from like we can see them from detecting them with a complex experiment, but we wouldn't see them just in day to day.
Yeah. And we used to think that the atom was the smallest unit. And then like, oh, no, the atom is made up of these smaller units. And now we're finding out that they're made up of even smaller units. So who knows how far down the road where it's like, oh, yeah, it just keeps going.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
like Russian doll, you know, those nesting dolls. So I want to make sure that we talk about supersymmetry in the 10 minutes that we have remaining. So yeah, you have 10 minutes to explain supersymmetry.
Cool.
Go.
Well, supersymmetry is perhaps a topic that's going to take more than 10 minutes to explain, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
So you'll have to bear with me, though. So in addition to some of the other classifications we were just talking about, like leptons and quarks, there are also a different classification system that we can use, which is called bosons and fermions.
Ooh, what are bosons and what are fermions?
Yeah, so fermions are most of the particles that we're actually familiar with. So protons act as fermions, neutrons are fermions, electrons are fermions. And what these fermions are particles that kind of, let's see, how do I put this? So,
as simply as possible.
I will do my best. So let's say we have a system that has a bunch of different particles in it.
Okay.
And it has a bunch of different energies that those particles can be in.
Okay.
So, like, they're kind of different states.
I'm thinking like children on a playground.
Yeah, exactly. And say you have a ton of swings, and maybe some of those swings are moving slower, some of them are moving faster, some of them are moving really fast.
Okay.
So, if we have fermions, if our children are fermions, then we can only fit one child per swing.
Okay.
Which is kind of, you know, because these are the particles we're very used to, it also goes along with our intuition. Only one child should fit towards one swing, right? But bosons are weird.
Okay.
So bosons, you can have one swing and somehow you can actually fit all of those children onto just one swing.
Interesting. And bosons are more mysterious, like you guys don't really understand them, or do you have a more grounded understanding of them?
So we do have a pretty grounded explanation for them. So they're actually so it turns out that forces are usually – they're not just kind of, you know, existing. We usually think of like – and maybe your high school physics, you're like, ah, I'm exerting a force on this table, right? By like pushing on it. And so that like goes with our intuition. So it turns out in the particle level, there's actually another particle, which are bosons, that is doing kind of that pushing to exert the force.
Okay.
So if you have one particle that interacts with electromagnetism, then it's going to emit a boson. And it's going to travel over to this other particle, and in doing that, that traveling, it's going to exert the force on the other particle. So if that other part, so say your first particle is positive, it's going to emit a boson, and the other particle is negative, then as soon as that particle reaches it, it's going to be like, ah, I should move toward. Exerting the force. So bosons, we actually do understand pretty well. They are weirder than we're used, like maybe used to in our physical intuition, but we actually do understand them pretty well.
Okay. Okay. See, when you were talking about bosons, I imagined like weightless children, and like the bosons were the ones that were like making them, you know, keeping them from floating away, like imposing something on them so that they stay in a particular order.
Maybe that's a good way of picturing it, I think.
Thinking of children floating away. Why is it called supersymmetry?
Yeah, so in our standard model, we have these bosons and we have fermions. And the idea of supersymmetry is that you actually are doubling the number of particles that we expect in the standard model, because you're going to say that every fermion actually has a partner that is a boson.
Ah.
And every boson has a partner that is a fermion.
Okay. Okay. And that's why it's supersymmetry,
right?
Because okay. I understood that.
Yeah.
Big star for me. All right. So we're almost out of time. I wish I could ask more, like a lot more questions. But I do want to ask, in your studies, what was something that you learned that blew your mind?
Ooh.
It could be big or small, but just something that, or something that just delighted you as soon as you read it. You're like, oh my gosh, I wish I could read that again and again.
So the first thing that comes to my mind is actually related to supersymmetry.
Okay.
So it's a pretty simple symmetry, as we just described.
Mm-hmm.
Every boson has a fermion. Every fermion has a boson. But the thing that blew my mind is that in particle physics, and in phenomenologically specifically, there's a bunch of questions that we have, you know, open questions that we haven't, like, figured out.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that if you incorporate supersymmetry into the model, then it actually fixes, like, all of those problems.
Oh.
Which is just kind of mind-blowing, right? That, like, one very simple change to your model can actually just, like, completely solve everything.
Like, if you use supersymmetry, it just doubles everything, and then it all works out.
Somehow it all works out.
Wow. Yeah, I could see how that would be delightful to just go, whoa. And was it a group effort, or did just someone one day just have a lightning bolt and went, supersymmetry?
It was definitely a group effort. And, you know, I actually don't remember who maybe came up with the exact first idea, but as soon as it was come up with, just like tons of people started
working on it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And this was actually a really big focus in the physics community, or particle physics community, for quite a while. And this is actually one of the main reasons the LHC, which is the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, the big particle accelerator, was created, was to try and detect supersymmetry.
Has it?
No.
Okay.
So this is the
But they're still trying.
They're still trying, and there's still hope.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a big thing that's been going on for particle physics, is we really thought we'd find it by now, and we haven't.
Yeah,
and so now we need to figure out why we haven't.
Well, life is so, you know, we exist in the blink of an eye, and so maybe it's just going to take some time.
Absolutely. And, like, I think people maybe got a little bit depressed about not finding it when they thought they should. And so actually, I think around, 2016, I think, was when we got, like, some of the first results from the LHC and started getting more data from it. And I think after that, there's been definitely a downfall in how much people thought supersymmetry is actually real. Even though it solves all the problems,
they're thinking
a lot
of it answers the questions, but we can't prove it, so maybe it doesn't exist,
or we just can't find it, so maybe it doesn't exist.
Okay, all right. Well, if people want to find out more about what you do specifically, how do they go about learning more?
Yeah, so there are definitively a lot of popular science articles that people can read, looking at dark matter, looking at supersymmetry. There's also a bunch of books that, like, I really enjoyed when I was younger and honestly still enjoy now, even though I don't have as much time to read them.
Give us one title.
I'm trying to think of titles. I can't think of titles, but Brian Greene is a really good author.
There you go.
And also Michio Kaku is also a good one.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So two different authors that you could pursue.
Okay. And then and the lab that you work out of is?
Yeah. So I work with Hitoshi Murayama, who's a professor at UC Berkeley.
All right. All right. Well, Bethany, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And now I've learned a bunch of new things. I've learned lepton. I've learned that every fermion has a boson, so that, you know, people are going to obviously co-opt that to have it some romantic thing. But I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks, thank you to Wonderfest for always providing these amazing scientists to thrill and explain things in a way that I can understand. So,
I've got the feeling you and me, we got a little chemistry. Can we talk about it? I've got the feeling you and me, we got a little chemistry. Can we talk about it? Let's talk about noble gases. Don't mean the ones our body passes. I mean HE for helium.
Also
NE for neon. RN is radon. AR is argon. KR stands for krypton. Isn't that where Superman came from? F stands for fluorine. CL for chlorine. BR is bromine. AT is astatine. I is for iodine. Now I need another line to fit right here. Oh well, forget it, never mind. O is for oxygen, yeah. N is for nitrogen, yeah. C is for carbon, yeah. B is for boron. I've got the feeling you and me, we got a little chemistry. Can we talk about it? I've got the feeling you and me, we got a little chemistry. Can we talk about it? Al is aluminum. Ga is gallium. In is indium. Tl is thallium. Si is silicone. Ge stands for germanium. Pb, that's for lead. Fl is fluorovium. Sn, that's for tin. Wanna get crazy, let's begin. Au is gold. That's something that we all wanna win. Pt is platinum. I'd love to have some.
I want to play more science stuff because we all learn things. But if I did continue playing Renaud Francoeur's A Little Chemistry from Brain Beats, we wouldn't be able to speak to Nick Oliveira about the speakeasy. So let's speak with Nick Oliveira. Hello, Nick Oliveira.
Hello, Marilyn. So good to hear your voice.
It's been years. I haven't heard from
you
in ages.
Oh, my God, it's been years.
Ages.
But it feels like no time has passed at all, doesn't it? Just a little blip. Just a little blip of the pandemic is all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a few years. It doesn't, you know, hardly affected the world at all, as a matter of fact. Nah.
Especially not theater. Not at all.
No, not at all. Theater's thriving. But in all seriousness, for our listening audience, Nick Oliveira is the founding executive director of Boxcar Theater. When did you found the theater?
Oh, golly, let's see, 2005.
We're
pushing 25. We're pushing 20 years.
Wow. And we all know that, you know, theater has its ups and downs, and the pandemic was particularly harsh on the theaters, and yet you have been able to weather it and to survive it. So tell us about that journey.
Oh boy! Theater's always been a kind of a historically challenging industry. Anyone in the arts, or you know, whether you're a painter or a sculptor or a theater practitioner. So we have kind of a little bit of a different business model. I used to do subscriptions, and back in the day when I'd come on your show, I'd talk about our seasons and that. And now we find shows that work, and we try to focus on those. And mm-hmm. we also do, with our space, we're very fortunate to have this beautiful venue, which we built out for the speakeasy, and we rent it out for private parties. We do weddings, and we do birthday parties, and we do big corporate parties, corporate events, and holiday parties. And that's really, that hybrid model has been able to sustain the company. As theater was a little slow to come back, mm-hmm. Some of the birthday parties and weddings and stuff that were on hold came back. And so we were able to do those and kind of oscillate. So we're a little different than a lot of other theaters out there, because we sometimes will do one show for a long time. Like when we ran Hedwig and Angry Inch, we ran that for 9 months, and mm-hmm. then we ran the Speakeasy for 3 years, and now we've been running The Illusionist, which is a magic show, and we've been running that for about I think, 3 years. And now we've closed that to bring back the speakeasy for a limited 10-week run. So we're only running it for a very short amount of time because it's a very challenging, it's a very epic, very big scope show. So it could be a little difficult to run for a long period of time. So yeah, that's a little bit of how we've been operating the past few years.
Okay, so for our listening audience and for me, describe what the speakeasy is and the inspiration for it.
Absolutely. Well, the speakeasy is a huge choose your own adventure. It's a labyrinth of rooms and storylines, and the audience, it gets to step back in time into the roaring 1920s and hobnob with gangsters and flappers and floozies and bootleggers. And you can follow any of these. I think there's about a dozen or so, probably almost close to two dozen storylines, about 20 performers. And you can follow their storylines throughout the different venues, and they intersect and kind of collide with one another. And sometimes you get pulled into the action. You might be a participant in a storyline or in a scene with some of these little breakaway scenes. And then there's also a big cabaret, which is like a traditional cabaret. We do vaudeville entertainment. We have the chorus girls doing big dance numbers to 1920s. You know, we got big band jazz music, 1920s, and they're doing California Here I Come and Blue Skies and some of these songs that you might go, I know that song. I've heard that song. They were the pop culture songs of the day. So we have the cabaret space going with our MC, Eddie the Unlucky, and our resident chanteuse, Miss Velma Louise Cole. And we also have a casino. So you could go play blackjack, craps, roulette. You can hang out in that room all night long. You can hang out in the cabaret all night long. You can go to the bar, follow some of the scenes. There are sing-alongs and dance parties. You know, it's kind of, the idea is like, we're doing the same stuff now that we did 100 years ago. So if we're doing sing-alongs, you know, now we're singing along to Neil Diamond. Back then, we would have sung along to Whiskey Johnny. Or if we're doing a dance party at the club, you know, instead of using techno hip-hop, we're using, you know, a gramophone with a record on it. So there's a lot of, like, you know, how we would have interacted and lived in the 1920s. And we give the audience the experience the opportunity to have those experiences.
Okay, so when someone steps into the speakeasy, are there different themes to each speakeasy? And are there, because you're talking about, you know, you're following this person's storyline or that person's storyline. That's question one about the themes. And then question two is, are you able to follow everybody's storyline when you walk through the door?
It's impossible to follow every storyline. Okay. Even I wrote it.
Okay.
I'm like, what happens now? It's about 1,000 pages of material.
Wow.
Which is actually reduced from the last time we ran it. It was 1,500. And I thought, maybe that's a little too much.
Okay.
It does encourage people to come back. You don't have to. What we do that's really interesting is a lot of the characters talk about the other like storylines and characters, kind of the way you would, kind of gossipy, that sort of thing. So even if you catch just a bit here and a bit there, you can start to put it all together. So it's not necessarily designed to follow one storyline. Mm-hmm. You might get bits and pieces, like life. You just get bits and pieces of this and that, and then you kind of create your own perception of that. There are a lot of different themes, and a lot of them, the show has evolved since we first opened in 2014, and then we did the 2016 to 2019 run, and I continue to kind of make updates to the script, a lot of it reflective of what's going on. So there are themes of you know, friendship and business. You know, there's the whole prohibition thing, which is kind of over all of it, you know, being illegal dealings, businesses and under the table kind of dealings, that sort of thing. But when you're in a bar, you might talk about love and romance, friendships. Some of those themes kind of happen in the bar. Mm-hmm. The casino has a little bit more luck driven, people gambling. There's this beautiful kind of a movement piece with the actors where we call it the gambling card montage, where it's this montage of movement with people gambling at a blackjack table in the cyclical repetitive nature of gambling. And it lasts a couple of minutes. And if you happen to be lucky enough to be in the casino, the lights change, the music changes, this piece comes to life, and then it goes away. And then you're back to playing craps and blackjack and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of different themes. There's also a dressing room, which we call the faux dressing room because it's actually like a set piece where the chorus girls, the vaudeville entertainers, they all go backstage and the audience is in an observation room behind a two-way mirror.
Okay.
So they're watching very voyeuristically what these characters are doing behind the scenes backstage. And it's all the fun things you can think of. You know, they're fighting and gossiping and making out, you know, with patrons and stuff. Not real patrons, but other characters. And all of that kind of shenanigans that happens backstage.
Okay. So it sounds like how big is the cast?
There's 19. In this cast.
Oh, okay. That's manageable, actually.
Plus the band. Yeah, it used to be 35. That's much bigger. There's a band. There's all the casino dealers. There's probably about 40, 50 people who work to make the show happen every single night.
Okay. So when the people come to the show, do you suggest that they try to dress period? Or because there's some people who don't have 20s attire. Or like, what do you recommend for them?
Yeah. Oh, we encourage it. It's not necessary. There's only a formal or cocktail dress code on Saturdays.
Mm.
We run Wednesday through Sunday. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday, you wear what you want to wear. But it's not hard to, you know, I always tell the guys, just tuck in your shirt. You look put on a jacket if you got it. You know, men, women always look great. You know,
yeah.
Men, I'm like, hey.
Lose the baseball cap.
Button that up, you know.
Yeah.
So Saturdays are cocktail attire. And we put away everyone's technical doodads, and it's an open bar, so we call it a VIP gala performance. So we really take the extra efforts on Saturdays to feel like you're completely immersed in the world. We hide all the POS systems, all the technologies hidden, and so it's like being in Westworld. You're just in another time, another world. The other days, which are also, you know, they're lower ticket prices and that sort of thing, like on a Wednesday, really good entry fee. But you don't have to get dressed up. And but we encourage it. You know, there's you can always go on Amazon, buy something if you want to throw on a fedora. But we hope that people play the game.
Do you ever have audience members who look so authentic that they look like they're part of the production?
Yeah, they look better than our actors. You know, we're still theater practitioners, so we have budgets. And,
right.
You know, I have to costume not just the 19 actors, but all the band and the front of house people and the coat check person needs to be in a tux. So, you know, we can only do so much, whereas, like, you know, one person, they might spend, you know, $500-$600 looking like the bee's knees, as they would say.
Right.
And I go, man, I've got to put you on stage. So our chanteuse, Velma Louise Cole, Miss Velma Louise Cole, we have to usually drop a pretty penny to make her look. She's got to be the best looking person in the club.
Sure.
So we do have to try to contend with our overzealous audience members. And there's quite a few.
The skirt
The
has
Bay
to
Area
be.
Is, I've always said this about the Bay. We like our costume parties.
Yes.
We like
yes,
to get dressed up when we like to go out, whether it's Burning Man or the Dickens Fair or the, you know, the
Edwardian Ball.
We do like to get dressed up.
Now, who's the band? Is it an unrelated group of people, or were they an actual band before?
No, it's a house band. So, yeah, we hire the chairs. So we've got, you know, piano and drums. And a lot of the people are coming back. We have probably about two-thirds of the people who are working on the show have been in one of the various runs. They're not all necessarily at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of folks come back. Some people came from North Carolina, across the country, Hawaii, just to work on the show again.
Oh,
they've left
the
Bay Area since the show closed in 2019. So we're really excited to welcome back so many people, and including the band. There's a lot of familiar faces. We're all getting a little bit longer in the tooth, as they say.
Sure.
You know, we've all put on a couple more gray hairs since we started this thing 10 years ago. We are celebrating our 10-year anniversary of premiering the show. So some people have been on the show that long.
Wow. So for our listening audience who's maybe getting back into going to theater, where is the Boxcar Theater? Where is the Speakeasy?
Yeah. And I always say, like, we're a little bit more than theater because we like to be an experiential, immersive night out.
Okay.
But the venue, which is located on Broadway, 644 Broadway.
Oh, okay.
We are we're right there. We're next to Sam's Burgers. I was just, you know, if you remember Sam's, shout out to Sam's.
Uh-huh.
Right on Broadway in Columbus. We're right there.
Okay, so the last time I was at the Boxcar, you were downtown. So you've moved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember those days. We, our first theater was in Soma on Natoma and 6th, which is a real cherry part of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then I took another venue on Hyde and Golden Gate, also pretty notorious. And we keep moving north. I keep joking we're going to be in Sausalito soon because we keep moving up north. We're now on North Beach, where the weather's always beautiful. And it's a great community out there. It's there's so many great restaurants and shops, and I mean it's got everything. City Lights Bookstore, Vesuvio's, like North Beach. We see a lot of people will come to the show. They'll go eat dinner up in North Beach, support some of the local restaurants, which we love. And then I personally love it because if people are wearing fedoras, they know they're coming to our show. And so, you know, right. They always see me. They're like, hey, you're the speakeasy guy, huh? Here, have an appetizer. But no, we like supporting our local restaurants. And then afterwards, if they haven't had enough drinks, and we got really good cocktails, and we've just revamped the cocktail program again. So there's a lot of new drinks on the menu. But if people still have a thirst, they'll go hit up, Comstock and some of the places nearby. We love being in North Beach.
Well, Nick, we have about 15 seconds left. So if people want to get tickets, where do they do that?
Okay, it's hard to remember, but it's thespeakeasysf.com. So you got to put the V in there, and then you got to put speakeasy, and then SF for San Francisco because we're San Francisco made and San Francisco proud. But that's it. Go to the website. We start performances this week. And we only run for 10 weeks. It's a limited run. We're closing up shop, and we got to get back to the other stuff we do, bringing back the Illusionist and doing our holiday parties this year.
All right. Well, Nick Oliveira, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me back. I miss being here. It's good to hop back into it.
Excellent. People of Earth, this is your opportunity, thespeakeasysf.com, to get tickets to go see the show. I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks because I will be chasing the eclipse. So I've made the show for the next 2 weeks. So until we meet again, my friends, ta-ta and tiddly-doo.